Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey. Hello, hello. What wild times these are. I hope most that you are staying safe and healthy and happy, and that you are spending time with your family and eating good food and being in the sunlight and exercising and have a smile on your face when you are listening to this week's podcast. I'm so excited to continue to share with you guys that my book, The Carnivore Code, is out and available, thecarnivorecodebook.com. Check it out. So many of the concepts that I discuss in this week's podcast are also detailed in my book, The Carnivore Code. We talk about insulin resistance in that book and in this podcast. We also talk about lipids in this podcast, and so many of the nuances regarding why LDL might not be as simple as higher LDL is worse. So check out my book, The Carnivore Code. If you like this podcast, please leave me a review on Amazon for the book and also a review on iTunes for this podcast. It is how we get it out to more people. The podcast is doing great. We reach tens of thousands of people every week, and I am so appreciative for your support. So on the podcast this week, I have my friend, Dr. Stephen Hussey. He is a doctor of chiropractic with a master's in human nutrition and functional medicine from the University of Western States in Portland, Oregon. He has a website, resourceyourhealth.com, and in this podcast, we break down his thoughts on coronavirus, my thoughts on coronavirus as this whole epidemic, pandemic continues to evolve. We talk about who is at most risk and the overlooked tragedy of coronavirus, which we both believe is that many people with underlying medical conditions, comorbidities, specifically hypertension, coronary artery disease, and diabetes, all diseases of increased insulin resistance, predispose those who are exposed to coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, to a more serious course of COVID-19, which is the illness. So what is so fascinating and at the same time tragic is that I hope that this discussion is not lost amidst the pandemic. I know that there are many emergency rooms throughout the country that are overloaded with people in metropolitan areas, and the social distancing is weighing on all of us, and the economic implications of all of this are weighing on all of us. And I don't think anyone really knows how to best move forward at this time, but we surely send our love and prayers and all of our support and deep gratitude to all of the healthcare workers on the front lines who are helping to care for all of our loved ones and our friends who are suffering with this virus. In the midst of all of this, I think it is critical that we do not lose the differentiation, the idea of who is most susceptible to this virus in a severe way and how we can correct that moving forward. In the past, with the previous influenza epidemics of multiple years, which have been very bad, diabetics have always been more susceptible, and I fear that we have not learned from this, and I hope that this time will be different. I hope that this time with coronavirus, we will remember who is at most risk with this virus and how to correct that moving forward, how to change insulin resistance, how to change our metabolic status so that we can all be strong, so that you can be the strongest individual possible for all of the viruses, bacteria, and insults that will happen in the future of our lives. So thank you guys for listening to this podcast. And thank you also to my sponsors, who include my newest sponsor. I'm so stoked to have these guys on board, blueblocks.com, B-L-U-B-L-O-X. These are in fact the best blue blocking glasses that I have ever found. I'm wearing them right now. I have the Jasper, which, if you have seen my Instagram stories, is a pretty darn cool set of blue blocking glasses. These are not the UVX glasses of old, and they are better than the UVX glasses of old because they are specifically formulated. I've met the owner, Andy, of this company, really great guy, really smart, really scientific, and he did a lot of research into which wavelengths, specifically 400 to 550 nanometers, are the best to block the blue and green wavelengths that can inhibit the production of melatonin by the suprachiasmatic nucleus. What does all that science mean to you? It means that in these trying times of coronavirus, we need to protect our sleep more than ever. And I am someone that protects my sleep as if it is my business. You better believe that in the evening, if I am around blue light, I am wearing blue light blocking glasses. And the two pair that I have, the Sleep Plus and the Light, both in the Jasper, look pretty darn cool, and I will wear the Jasper at any time, the clear one, which is the light glasses, and people don't even know I'm wearing blue blocking glasses, so if I'm at a restaurant, or I'm at dinner, or I'm out in public at night, I can really look cool, look studious and professorly in my blue blocking glasses that really just look like a very hipsterific, awesome pair of glasses. So check out blueblocks.com. They've done the research, they've done the science, and they are really leading the way with what I believe are the best blue blocking glasses out there. You can use the code CarnivoreMD for 15% off your order. They've got all kinds of styles. Again, I like the Jasper. If you want to be like me, check the Jasper out. I got the Sleep Plus and the Light, but I think that these guys are doing great work to help us all stay stylish. You can either look like Elton John with the orange lenses, or you can have the clear lenses and be kind of incognito with your blue blockers and protect your circadian rhythms. Another thing that's amazing for me in these days is the work that our friends at White Oak Pastures are doing to provide us all with some of the best meat on this here planet. This is a sixth generation farm in Bluffton, Georgia, and they have had 150 years on this farm. The last 20 of them have been regenerative, meaning that they have been farming the soil in the right way, rotating crop, rotating animals, and looking at the amount of organic matter in the soil, which is constantly increasing. Via life cycle analyses, they are carbon negative, and my goodness, this is probably the best meat I have ever tasted. I've been to the farm. I've hung out with Jenny and Will. Will Harris is the owner, and his daughter Jenny run the farm, and it is an amazing, really, really special place. We were hoping to do White Oak Cella there in the spring, and we are going to move it to the fall. It is probably going to be the second weekend in October. Stay tuned for the rescheduling of White Oak Cella. But it's probably not the best time to be going to the grocery store if we don't need to be. Why not get some of the best meat on the planet delivered to your door in a regenerative fashion? They are doing their absolute best to get us all this meat as expediently as possible. And my goodness, there's some amazing stuff. If you guys want to know a secret, I love the tenderloin tips and tails. I would not tell you guys how much I like these if I did not love you even more, because now my favorite things are going to be sold out. But check out all their stuff. Their ribeyes are out of this world. They have organ meats. They have so many different animals. WhiteOakPastures.com. You can use CarnivoreMD for 10% off your first order from them, and give Sarah a call. Call White Oak Pastures, talk to Sarah, tell them I sent you, and tell them that she is doing an amazing job and that you guys love and appreciate her, because Sarah and Jenny and Will and everyone at White Oak is just amazing. These are really good people, and they are giving us some amazingly good meat to nourish us and to care for animals in a very profound way. And the last sponsor is never the least. These are ancestral supplements. These are the grass-fed, grass-finished, desiccated organ meats and all sorts of amazing things, parts of the animal from New Zealand, from my friends in Houston, Texas, www.ancestralsupplements.com. These are amazing supplements. These are probably some of the best organs on the planet being desiccated, low temperature dehydrated into gelatin capsules. So they're so convenient to take if you're on the go, if you're traveling, if you don't have access to organs, or you are just not ready to eat liver at this point, which is totally okay. But there are so many good things in these organ meats. And I have been doing some research for my upcoming cookbook, which will be out much later this year, probably close to fall and winter. And one of the things that I came across was that the desiccation process is unique in that because it's a low temperature dehydration process, it preserves many of the nutrients in special ways. They've done experiments with low temperature desiccated or low temperature dehydrated desiccated organ meats, especially liver, and found it to have potentially some pretty amazing properties, at least in animal experiments with mice, that improved the mouse energy models in ways that cooked organs did not. So if you're going to eat your liver, eat it raw or eat it desiccated in the form of a gelatin capsule. And there's nobody doing that better right now than Ancestral Supplements. At ancestralsupplements.com, you can always use the code SaladinoMD on their Shopify site for 10% off your order. And you guys know that I love them. When I provide these to my family, I have a mother and a father who are going to be 70 this year. Mom and Dad, if you're listening to this, I love you. And I have a sister who has the most beautiful children ever. I have a niece and a nephew, and I have made sure to send them all desiccated organs in these times to make sure their nutrition is nose to tail and they are fully nourished. So check out Ancestral Supplements. I've been thinking also about the thymus and lung recently for immune support in the times of these respiratory virus. they are putting back in what the modern world has left out. And my goodness, we all know the modern world has left out so much. All right, on to the podcast. I love you all. Listen later for what is going on with me after the podcast. All right, Dr. Stephen Hussey, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on, my friend.
This is awesome. I'm glad to be here.
Where do we even begin? Let's just start the podcast with some consideration of where we are at this point in time. Today is, I got to look at my clock because every day feels like Groundhog Day amidst the coronavirus pandemic. Today is April the 5th. I just want to get your sense on where we are, how we got here, and how we move forward with this.
Yeah, I think that, you know, obviously there was this huge scare. I think that, you know, when this virus started coming out and getting into the media, you know, people were scared they were going to get a virus. And, you know, that's kind of how things, I think, I don't want to say get out of control, but they can, and I don't want to say overblown either, because it is a serious situation. But I think that sometimes when something like this happens and it blows up so quickly, I think sometimes the focus gets skewed. You know, what should we be focusing on? And why is this really happening? You know, is this something that we could have done nothing about as far as the virus goes? Potentially no. But as far as the effect the virus is having, could there have been something we could do something about, or we could have done something about if we had, you know, paid attention to previous pandemics that maybe weren't as bad as this one? And I think that reflecting back and looking back on that can give us direction going forward as far as what we should be doing to protect ourselves from this.
And I think that's a great point, that in the midst of what appears to be a lot of fear, sometimes bordering on hysteria, I hope that you and I can begin, and many others in space can continue to add pieces to this conversation as we look forward. There's so much concern right now about sort of how we protect ourselves from the virus and not getting the virus. And I think that's an important consideration. And I think not overwhelming the healthcare system acutely is an important consideration. And I think that the other side of that equation that I have not seen as much discussion about is how severe the course may be in any individual. And this is something that you've highlighted and I've tried to highlight as well. And I think that's what we're going to talk about mostly today is, look, I think most people or many people believe that many of us will be exposed to this. Just like we don't hide from seasonal flu, we don't hide from seasonal colds, eventually the quarantines and self-distancing will stop. And at that point, many of us will be exposed to the virus. If you look at the curves for flattening the curve type of modeling, the area under both of those curves is the same, meaning that there's a steep curve in which a lot of people get the virus all at once. And the concern is that if a lot of people get the virus all at once, maybe we will overwhelm the healthcare system. Yes, it's a possibility. And there's a more flat curve in which the same number of people, the area under the curve is the same, get the virus over a longer amount of time, and the healthcare system capacity is not sort of overwhelmed. And I think that that's what we're hoping for now with social distancing and quarantine. And that's a reasonable thing, I believe. And from what I've seen so far, there are some hospitals in New York City that are pretty full, but that thankfully there are many hospitals in other parts of the country that are not yet completely overwhelmed. Like I said, we're recording this on April the 5th. I think the next week or two will be very telling in terms of how many people will get sick and how many people will need hospitalization. So for me, this is not so much a conversation about avoiding getting the virus, because I think, like I said, we are all going to be exposed to viruses throughout our lives and we should not hide from these. I think that the more important conversation as humans is how do we make our immune system as strong as possible? And how do we stand strong in the face of all the insults we are going to suffer throughout our lives, whether it's flu, coronavirus, a different coronavirus, a different virus, a bacteria, MRSA, VRE, all these things. And so that's what we're going to talk about today is just, you know, if we imagine that we are all going to be exposed to these things at some point. If it's not this infection, it's another one. How does our body react to that? So I think that's a great place to start. I just want to give people an update at this point. Again, I've talked about this on my social media. I like this website, the 1.3 Acres website on the updates of where the coronavirus is going. On April the 4th, as you can see in the video here, there were a total of 312,000 cases, 788. And there were 34,592 new cases. I think the number most people are looking at is this death toll and the question of how quickly the deaths will double. There was a lot of concern about the doubling rate of the deaths and that it was going to be 2 to 3 days. But at least the way we're trending now, on the 31st of March, there were 4,000 deaths. And then there were, to get to over 8,000 deaths, we had to go to the 4th of March. So that's 4 days. So perhaps we are beginning to slow the rate of deaths and things will not be quite as bleak as some may predict. I think that, like I said, the main thing will be what we see in the next few weeks. So we talked a little bit about this before the podcast, but let's just give people an outline. I talked about this in my coronavirus podcast. Let's talk about what a coronavirus is and how it's entering the lungs and what this means for us right now.
Yeah, so there's a as far as I know, three different coronaviruses that we're aware of, and they are MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, the first SARS virus, and then now we have the second one that we're dealing with now. And so a virus is basically, you know, something that needs to be able to access the cell in some way, and it does that through a receptor in the cell. In this case, the coronavirus or SARS-2 accesses the ACE2 receptor on the cell. And so then when that happens, it can access our cellular, you know, material, and it can hijack our DNA, RNA specifically, and it can start making copies of itself and kind of using our machinery for its benefit. And so that's kind of, you know, so then we have to look at the places where, you know, we have a high amount of these receptors in our body. And so it makes sense based on what we're seeing, I think, that we have very high amounts of ACE2 receptors in cells in the lungs and also in the GI system. So, you know, if you happen to, you know, not just breathe something in, but ingest something with some live coronavirus on it, if your stomach acid wasn't potent enough, maybe it survived. Or however it can get in there. So that's the main two ways I think that the virus is taking hold of people's lungs and GI system.
Yeah. And as you point out in a blog post that you did that I'll link to, which I thought was really good, the overlooked tragedy of coronavirus, there are three that have been really serious, MERS, SARS-1, and SARS-2, but there are many different types of coronaviruses that cause the common cold. There's 299E, NL63, OC43, HKU1, there's beta and alpha coronaviruses. So coronaviruses have been around for a long time, which was why in the beginning people were saying this is just like the common cold. And in some ways it is, and in some ways it definitely is not, because the common cold doesn't usually get this much damage in the lungs. And as you're suggesting, when this coronavirus, when SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID-19, which is the disease state, gets into our lungs, it binds to the ACE2 receptor. And I just want to talk about this because I think it's relevant to a lot of people who may be listening to this, or a lot of people who may, the people listening to this may know. It's binding to the ACE2 receptor. This is the angiotensin converting enzyme 2 receptor. As I talked about in the first podcast I did on coronavirus, this converts angiotensin 2 to angiotensin 1-7 and kind of inactivates angiotensin 2. So in this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, which I detailed in that previous podcast, there are two positions in that sort of biochemical pathway that drugs that people are commonly taking now can affect us. We've got ACE inhibitors and we've got ARBs. And so what are your thoughts, and then I'll offer my thoughts, on ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers and how they could be affecting things right now?
Yeah, I mean, my first thought off the bat is that for most people who are taking these drugs, the issue that the drugs are trying to help them with could be corrected in other ways,
right?
Which we're gonna get into. But so when we look at how these drugs work, and we look at how the virus is gaining access and really taking hold of people through the ACE2 receptor, you know, if you take an ACE inhibitor, what that's doing is preventing the conversion of angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. And angiotensin 2 is the molecule that when your body thinks we need higher blood pressure for whatever reason, that's the molecule that goes and signals to the body that it needs to happen. And so an ACE inhibitor is a blood pressure medication that's inhibiting the formation of that angiotensin II. And so that will lower the blood pressure. However, if we have ACE2 receptors around, and all of a sudden there's less angiotensin II available to those receptors, or maybe the body needs higher blood pressure and it's not happening because the angiotensin II is not there, maybe we upregulate the receptors for angiotensin II, then there's more ACE2 receptors for the virus to get a hold of. And so it makes sense that we would see a correlation between, you know, taking ACE inhibitors and people doing worse on the virus, or maybe contracting it easier, or however we want to define it. And then there's other blood pressure medications, which we were talking a little bit about before the podcast, which are angiotensin receptor blockers, ARBs. And so these, I was telling you about how, like, I've seen the research that shows that you know, when we take these, ACE2 receptors are increased. But I didn't quite understand the mechanism of how that was based on how they worked. I think we clarified a little bit. But if we're blocking the receptors that angiotensin II would work on, then the body's thinking, oh, we don't have enough receptors or whatever. And so it upregulates the receptors. And so we get more ACE2 receptors, making the virus have, you know, pick and choose whatever, however it wants to get in. There's more options for it to get in. So it seems that people on these, I would say that not only are these two medications, but also the fact that people have hypertension in general may lead to an increase in these receptors as well. So not only is the disease itself, or the, you know, the imbalance itself creating more receptors, but the things that we're treating them with could leave people more vulnerable.
Yeah, I think this is a really important point to dwell on for another moment, that this system, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, is one of the systems in the body by which we regulate fluids and our fluid volume. And there are drugs that can inhibit the function of this system and thereby lower blood pressure. But as you point out, and I agree with this, a lot of hypertension is driven by insulin resistance, which is what this podcast is really about. And I think that a lot of the poor outcomes in people with hypertension and coronavirus, SARS-2, developing COVID-19, are pointing to the fact that insulin resistance is a bad thing for humans in general and makes us more susceptible. Specifically with regard to ACE2 receptors, I do think there's a pattern that those with less ACE2 receptors, which appear to be children, incidentally, have an easier course with the disease, and those with more ACE2 receptors, those taking ACE inhibitors, angiotensin receptor blockers, or those with hypertension, perhaps, have a more severe course of the disease. We're not really talking about who gets coronavirus or who is exposed to it. We're talking about the severity of the illness course once you get it. Like I said, I think we both agree that the majority of us, 50, 60% of the population, who knows, will be exposed to coronavirus. It's how serious is the course. So in this situation, in this model, we could imagine that if you have more points of entry, if you have more doors on your house, there's more places where a burglar could come in. And if a whole bunch of burglars show up at your house, and there's a lot of doors that are unlocked, there's a lot of ACE2 receptors, maybe more burglars come into your house. And if there's more burglars, they steal more stuff, right? That's a worse situation. So that's a very crude comparison for what might be going on in a coronavirus infection. But I think it perhaps is accurate. Now, the part of this equation that really starts to be interesting for me is that the main governing bodies within medicine, the European Society of Hypertension, the American Nephrologic Society, have not recommended that people stop these medications. And I think that I disagree with this. Of course, no podcast is ever meant to be formal medical advice. Neither you nor I are offering medical advice. But what's great about podcasting is we can offer opinion. And so, you know, as clinicians, I would be curious for your opinion on this, but my opinion is that if someone is taking an ACE inhibitor or an angiotensin receptor blocker, why not talk to your physician? Firstly, why not talk to your physician about changing that medication to something else, like a calcium channel blocker that may not have the same mechanism to increase ACE receptors in your lungs, but still might control your hypertension in the short term? And secondly, if you're taking a blood pressure medication, think about, and this is what we're going to talk about in this podcast, think about why you have high blood pressure in the first place. But what's your thought on that? If you had a client or a patient taking an ACE inhibitor or an ARB, and again, we'll make it very clear, this is not medical advice.
Yeah, I would have them, you know, confront their doctor. I would give them information and I would say, hey, go to your doctor, maybe not confront, but just go to your doctor and say, hey, look at this information. You know, do you think that, or what do you think about this? Do you, what's your clinical opinion and what should we do? I mean, and I think there's, you know, I tell people this a lot. I think that, you know, high blood pressure, it's been associated with a lot of things, you know, a lot of worse outcomes with a lot of diseases. But I think that the thing that's causing high blood pressure, which is insulin resistance and metabolic derangement, I think, are also the same things that are causing all the bad things that hypertension is associated with. So is hypertension, you know, is it causing heart disease and all these different things? Or is it just also happening because of these underlying imbalances in our metabolism? And so when I think about it that way, I think, you know, would it be the end of the world if, you know, maybe we switched to another medication or went off it for a while or something, if it did allow us to combat this virus better, you know, because quite certainly, I mean, high blood pressure is not going to kill you tomorrow.
Hope not. I guess it could. You never know.
I guess so. But it's way less dangerous than low blood pressure. You know, low blood pressure, you're going to pass out and die pretty instantly if it gets too low anyways.
Yeah, acutely. And I think that the recommendation, at least from my perspective, and I imagine yours too, is not to completely stop all your blood pressure medications.
Right.
That could be dangerous, but to talk to a physician and say, would it be reasonable to switch to a calcium channel blocker, which are pretty much first line for blood pressure anyway. You could also consider a diuretic. Those have their own side effects. I mean, no blood pressure medication is ideal, but I think that in the setting of coronavirus, if someone has insulin resistance and hypertension, maybe these medications are not the best option right now. Now, we should also mention that in people with diabetes, which is what we're going to talk about in a moment, ACE inhibitors and ARBs are first line for blood pressure because they appear to protect the kidneys from damage that can occur there and cause, you know, albuminuria, the loss of protein in the urine. So patients with diabetes and hypertension may have physicians who are hesitant to take them off an ACE inhibitor. Again, it gets to be a little bit of a sticky conversation, but I don't think I would not hypothetically want to see someone's blood pressure increase acutely. It's an interesting question to raise though. Is it perhaps better in the time of a virus that enters the lungs, that enters the type 2 pneumocytes through the angiotensin converting enzyme 2 receptor, right, to maybe not have that receptor be super high?
Yeah, and that's just maybe something we don't know the answer to, you know.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that I feel like, I mean, you brought up diabetes, and you know, I'm type 1 diabetic, and so I know that when I think I was 22 years old, my endocrinologist wanted me on an ACE inhibitor, lisinopril, and my blood pressure at the visit was 112/72, and at 22, I didn't know really much of anything at that time, you know, but I just thought, you know, I feel like if I lower it anymore, isn't that going to be dangerous? And so it just, you know, especially people in the case of diabetes, I mean, he wanted to protect my kidneys. That was his thinking. And so in the case of diabetes, like maybe people are on these things, but maybe they don't have hypertension. It's just a preventative thing for their kidneys. And so that's something I would bring up to my doctor and see what they thought about that.
Yeah. And maybe in this podcast, we won't really get into the mechanism of kidney damage and diabetes. I think that the hypothesis that I've always used, or that I remember from medical school, was that if there's increased levels of blood glucose, which we're also going to talk about in this podcast, you know, are more of the cells in the kidney, are more of the cells in the glomerulus, which is sort of the functional unit of the kidney, in the nephron, are more of them getting glycosylated, are more of them having sugar molecules attached to them. Does that change the recycling of those cells? Does that mean that they age, quote unquote, faster? Does that mean that the kidneys get damaged? And could having less pressure in the glomerulus save the kidney from progression to leaking protein, specifically albumin? That's the question we're asking with ACE inhibitors. But as always happens with medicine, it's always multifactorial. And I think you bring up a good point that acutely, you know, it is possible, or it seems possible to me, that having less ACE receptors in the lungs might be a good thing. And that might be worth perhaps a little bit more pressure in the glomerulus for someone with diabetes or hypertension, but we don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know So that's interesting that you have type 1 diabetes. We'll circle back to that soon. So let's ask, what I think is perhaps the one of the more important questions amidst coronavirus right now is, are healthy people at risk for this virus? And I want to make it really clear, and I know the listener will probably not believe or make, you know, this error of judgment, but I just want to make it very clear that both of us are very worried about this virus and very saddened by the loss of life. And none of the discussions in this podcast are meant to be judgmental to anyone listening with obesity, diabetes, hypertension, or anything like that. This is not meant to be quote unquote fat shaming. This is meant to be an informational session in which we ask questions and help anyone listening to this or anyone listening to this who knows people with these diseases empower themselves to make positive changes. None of us, neither you nor I, is suggesting that we are perfect or free from illness at some point in our lives, that we've both eaten cookies. We've probably both had higher and lower levels of insulin resistance in our own lives. I've certainly had my battles with illness in the past. So none of this is meant to be judgmental to anyone with any of these illnesses listening to this podcast. And nor are we meaning to make it sound in any way, shape, or form as though we are judging those people. So when I say, are healthy people at risk for this illness, it's from a place of real, you know, empathy and concern for both those who are sick and quote unquote healthy. But what do we think about this? Because the media reports right now, I think some of the most, I don't know if inflammatory is the right word, but the most reposted, the most controversial, or the most attention gathering media reports, in my opinion, are those that say healthy, quote, 42-year-old dies from coronavirus. And I just think we should examine these in a little more detail. So what's your thought about this? What have you seen, and then I'll offer my opinion, about the risk that, quote, healthy people have of having a severe illness with coronavirus? And the corollary question is, how do we define healthy?
Yeah, I was just going to say the same thing, is we got to define healthy because, you know, I guess you could consider someone who, a 42-year-old who has no, you know, testing or markers on blood work or some indication that they're unhealthy, but who's also a smoker, could be considered one of those healthy people, you know, because they don't just because they don't meet the criteria for being unhealthy according to our definition, but they're still putting themselves at risk. So I guess we just really need to define healthy, and I don't know that we have that. I think everybody has different definitions of that, but as far as, you know, whether healthy people are less at risk or more at risk or whatever, I think that if we're talking about contracting the virus, I think we're all at the same risk. You know, we could all be exposed to it and it could all gain access to ourselves. But as far as like the risk, as far as a worse outcome, I think that, again, we have to define what's healthy, because if we're not looking at, I mean, I say this to people all the time, and I work with people all the time. We get a blood work back that's, you know, looks normal, and in Western medicine, we'll give them a clean bill of health, you know. But in reality, they came to me because they had a symptom, and so that indicates to me that there's something going wrong with their physiology that's not showing up on blood work. So we can't give them a clean bill of health, and so I think I saw something. Today, actually, I saw, or maybe it was yesterday, a study that had come out of China that said that 3 out of 4 people affected by the virus won't have symptoms, you know, according to their numbers. Now, who knows if that's true or accurate? There's so much stuff coming out. But to me, it just says, okay, so what's the difference between those 3 and that 4th person that did have symptoms? You know, we got to find that out. And, you know, there seems to be some evidence that, you know, being metabolically unhealthy, I call it metabolically unhealthy, deranged metabolism, is predisposing, or it may be the link or the factor that is the difference between these 3 people that didn't get symptoms even though they had it and the 4th one that did. So
yeah, and I think this discussion is something that we are both trying to advance. how do we define healthy in the population? Is healthy, you know, and again, I want to make it very clear that I'm not trying to be insensitive, but if a healthy 42-year-old dies, is healthy having a BMI less than, you know, having a non-obese BMI and not overt blood pressure and being on no medications? What do we know about that person's nutritional status? How many physicians today draw a fasting insulin? And how many within the medical sphere would know what range would be healthy? Because the reference range for fasting insulin goes, I believe, up to 15 or 16, in some assays up to 20. And if I see a client and their fasting insulin is greater than four, I'm thinking this isn't right. Like, that's probably a little bit of insulin resistance. So there's not formal criteria. We can use fasting insulin and we can use C-peptide to get a sense of insulin resistance. And I think that that's going to become a real theme of this podcast. How does someone know if they are insulin resistant? I talked about that a lot in my book, The Carnivore Code. And I think that was a main question that a lot of people are going to have, because insulin resistance is a huge piece of my thinking around diet and atherosclerosis, as I talk about in the book as well. But it goes on to say that when someone, as you suggest, gets their labs back from a doctor, what labs do they usually get? A comprehensive metabolic panel, maybe a basic metabolic panel, and a CBC and lipids. That's usually all that is drawn. And so if someone has a complete blood count, a basic metabolic panel, and blood cholesterol that is not abnormal, we might call them healthy. And you and I both know that's essentially just the tip of the iceberg. There are so many more metabolic metrics that could be looked at that really give an indication of metabolic health. That's really only scratching the surface on metabolic health. Perhaps the best marker in that sort of a blood work would be a fasting glucose. And someone might say, well, if your fasting glucose isn't elevated, you don't have any issues, right? But you and I both know that people can have a fasting glucose that's only mildly elevated or not really elevated and still have a fasting insulin that's elevated, or have underlying insulin resistance, or have nutritional deficiencies that are not going to show up on that panel. So from my perspective, and this is a difficult thing for me to know because I can't see the cases of all these people who are being reported in the media as healthy. Certainly there are people in the media who were reported as quote healthy, and they show pictures of these people, you know, and it's sad because they've died, but they're obese. And so you think, okay, that person sadly probably wasn't that healthy, but the media is considering them healthy. And again, I want to be very sensitive to this because they've passed away from coronavirus. But as physicians, we need to take that information and really clarify it so that we can help those who are still living and how they address the virus. So that's, I think, the first call that we are trying to make to the community is redefine healthy, really understand metabolic health, and do metrics that give a real understanding or a real, you know, appraisal of metabolic health. And don't call someone healthy without looking at insulin sensitivity and nutrients and all these things. And then we can really, like you say, understand why those three people did fine and the fourth person didn't. That's the key. I posted something on my Instagram. There was an ICU physician who went on the news, and he said that in his ICU, there were 15 patients with coronavirus on ventilators. 14 of them had diabetes or prediabetes. And the 15th one was a 94-year-old man who they didn't even know what his metabolic status was, because once someone gets that sick, you really can't look at their fasting insulin to tell if they have insulin resistance. But you can imagine a 94-year-old man might not have the best immune system with a poor diet. So that to me was very striking, and it's kind of what you were saying as well. Mm-hmm. So what other data have you seen coming out of China regarding comorbidities? Because we talked about this a lot before the podcast. Let's just review some of the data that you and I have both seen regarding, you know, from China, which is really all we have at this point, other than these eyewitness reports from American physicians in ICUs. What have you seen out of China in terms of comorbidities and the severity of coronavirus infections?
The two studies that I linked to in the post that I did, one of them, I think, just said heart disease and diabetes. And then the other one was the hypertension, diabetes, and heart disease were the three most common comorbidities they found in people who, in the hospital they were treating for coronavirus. And so, I think, do you have these pulled up?
I can pull them up. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think one was relatively smaller, and I can't remember, but I think there was one that was 191 people, and I think about half of them had some sort of metabolic disease, and then there was the three that were the most common were the heart disease, hypertension, and diabetes.
Yeah, so I pulled them up here. So this is one of the ones that you mention. This is from Lancet Respiratory Medicine. The title of the study is Clinical Course and Outcomes of Critically Ill Patients with SARS-CoV-2 Pneumonia in Wuhan. It's a single-centered retrospective observational study. So it's an observational study, but the findings are pretty striking. It says the mortality of critically ill patients with SARS-CoV-2 pneumonia is considerable. And it talks about the comorbidities in the findings here. And you can see that the mean age of 52 patients was 59.7. 40% had chronic illness. And so 40% had chronic illness. And then it talks about who was more likely to develop acute respiratory distress syndrome and these other comorbidities. And when you look at the study, it is true that the majority of the people who were likely to develop the more severe complications, which are ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome, which is a severe pneumonia, and perhaps death, were likely to have comorbidities, which included hypertension, coronary artery disease, et cetera, which we know are connected with insulin resistance. The second
even there, it said chronic kidney disease was also one of the things they noticed. And to me, that's also insulin resistance.
Yes.
So there's just another one there.
Chronic kidney disease is connected with diabetes, connected with hypertension. This is another one. So many of these are quickly published. So many of them are preprints and not peer reviewed, but I think that most of us are accepting that at this point in the coronavirus. This is comorbidity and its impact on 1,590 patients with COVID-19 in China. It's a nationwide analysis. And you can see that severe cases accounted for 16% of the population, and 131 patients reached the composite endpoints, which were severe complications, admission to the ICU, invasive ventilation, or death. And of those patients, 25% had at least one comorbidity, and they included hypertension, cardiovascular disease, cerebrovascular disease, diabetes, hepatitis, COPD, chronic kidney diseases, malignancy, immunodeficiency, respectively. And these are pretty staggering numbers that it's really favoring these people. 8% had two or more comorbidities, and patients with two or more comorbidities had significantly escalated risks of reaching the composite endpoint compared to those with a single comorbidity. Now, it should be noted in this study that this is just the people that reported having these comorbidities. This wasn't even, once someone comes to the ICU or comes to a hospital and they have a severe illness, they're not necessarily going to do a whole lot of testing for these things. You know, you can't really say somebody has hypertension or cardiovascular disease or cerebrovascular disease or diabetes or hepatitis B or COPD once they're intubated. This is the history. So I think these numbers would be even larger if they had been evaluated more thoroughly as an outpatient before they became ill. This is just 25% of people reaching the composite endpoints had, the people reaching the composite endpoints were much more likely to have these things. And the people that reached the composite endpoints, those were the people that knew they had these diseases. The last one is risk factors associated with acute respiratory distress syndrome and death in patients with coronavirus. Again, this is from JAMA. This one does look like it's been peer reviewed. Same kind of things. In this cohort study of 201 patients, risk factors associated with the development of ARDS, again, this is acute respiratory distress syndrome, and progression from ARDS to death include older age, neutrophilia, which we can talk about. Neutrophils are one of the cells of the immune system, and organ and coagulation dysfunction. And if you read further into the paper and look at the people and you look at the epidemiology, you will see that the same comorbidities are found over and over in these people with hypertension and others up here. So you had hypertension, cardiovascular disease, et cetera. So when we are thinking about this, what do you make of all this? What, you know, how do you make sense of all this?
Well, I mean, and specifically in the case of diabetes, I think about, to me, I automatically think, why is diabetes giving this virus an advantage? You know, because that's what it is. I think, you know, for some reason in these people who, you know, diabetes is characterized by higher blood sugars, you know, why is that giving the viruses an advantage? So I linked a couple studies in the post I did that showed, not with specifically with coronavirus, because, you know, the data is still pretty new, but showed that in other viruses, when they put those viruses into a medium that was saturated with glucose, they affected the cell much more severely. And so, you know, maybe glucose is some sort of fuel for this virus. And so if we combine that with the fact of what we just talked about with, you know, hypertension and the potential use of blood pressure medications, increasing the ACE2 receptor, plus maybe this person has higher blood sugars. Like, we're just creating an environment where this virus is just, it's able to just wreak havoc on our system. And so when we look at these studies and we see the people, like you said on that interview that they did, that, you know, 14 of the patients had diabetes, it makes complete sense in my head that the virus would be opportunistic to an extent to affect these people more.
Absolutely. And there's, like you said, there have been no studies specifically with coronavirus, but there's a heck of a lot of data regarding the way that many things, insulin resistance and acute hyperglycemia, can affect the immune system. So I pulled up a couple of papers. I don't know if you mentioned this one, but I'll share it. I'll screen share it. This one's actually pretty interesting. So the effect of short-term hyperglycemia on the innate immune system. And we can talk about the innate versus the adaptive immune system in a moment. The innate immune system is things like macrophages derived from monocytes, dendritic cells, natural killer cells, neutrophils, eosinophils, basophils. Man, it just sounds like an alphabet soup of immune cells, but I'll walk the listener through it in a moment. But this is a really interesting article. It talks about the effect of short-term hyperglycemia. Now, they say that hyperglycemia activates protein kinase C, which is a signaling pathway in these immune cells. It inhibits neutrophil migration, phagocytosis, superoxide production, which is part of microbial killing. Now, it's important to mention that in this paper, they are looking at very high levels of blood glucose. And I think that perhaps it would be interesting to get your take on this as well. The levels of blood glucose that they're looking at in this paper are 250 milligrams per deciliter plus, which is something that's not uncommon in someone with type 2 diabetes, but should be uncommon in those of us that have insulin sensitivity and metabolic health. Incidentally, I've been wearing a continuous glucose monitor the last 5 days, and it's been really fascinating. The listeners to this podcast will know that I think we both eat carnivore diets, and I've been playing around with honey in my carnivore diet. And I want to make it clear to people that, at least myself, I'd love your take on this, I'm not convinced that carbohydrates are bad for humans in and of themselves. I think excess carbohydrates or carbohydrates combined with vegetable oils are particularly damaging. And certainly in the setting of type 1 diabetes, there may be a different context that you can speak from. But from my perspective, what I have observed with my continuous glucose monitor is that when I eat honey, and I've been doing it for the last few weeks twice a day with my meals, I can see with my CGM that my blood sugar goes from about 85 to about 125. And so it moves up about 30 to 40 points, 30 to 40 milligrams per deciliter pretty quickly. And then it's back down to baseline within 30 to 40 minutes every single time. Sometimes it's back down to baseline within 20 minutes. The CGM monitors my blood sugar every 15 minutes, I believe. This one is from, it's a Freestyle Libre. And you can see, and I'll publish these results of full carnivore days. Well, I actually think that honey is totally carnivore because it's not really from a plant, but I'll publish keto carnivore days and I will publish carbohydrate containing carnivore days. I wanted to do this experiment, but what I have observed is that my blood sugar never really goes above 130 when I'm eating honey. And so to have someone get a postprandial blood sugar of 250 is astronomical. Or for anyone to see a postprandial rise in blood sugar of more than 30 to 40 milligrams per deciliter, to me, that indicates probably some degree of metabolic dysfunction. I was talking to one of my clients yesterday who's an OBGYN in Australia, and we were talking about OGTTs, so oral glucose tolerance tests that are done for pregnant women. And the criteria to fail, this is also called a glucola test. The criteria to fail a glucola test is pretty ridiculous. What you do is you give someone 75 milligrams of carbohydrates in a sugar solution. And certainly some mornings, I think I'm getting 50 to 75 milligrams of carbohydrates with a few tablespoons of honey. So I'm essentially doing an oral glucose tolerance on myself every morning right now. If you give a pregnant woman an oral glucose tolerance test with 75 milligrams of glucose, they fail that tolerance test if their blood sugar is above 180 or 200 at 1 hour. At 1 hour. So here I am doing that test on myself, and I'm seeing my blood sugar go up to 120 or 130 and go back down immediately within 30 minutes. So to see a blood sugar at 200 1 hour after eating a glucose load would be very, very intense. And I think there's even, my point that I'm making is that I think that's even not stringent enough. You know, I think we could even say 50 milligrams per deciliter or 60 milligram per deciliter increase. We're talking about pregnant women having 100 plus milligram per deciliter increases in glucose that persist for more than 1 hour to be diagnosed as diabetic within pregnancy. So I just thought that was really interesting. And I just want people to know that when we are talking about these, when we are talking about these numbers, to know what might be an abnormal glucose or what might be a good glucose to have after a meal. That's why the CGM I think is so cool. The one I've been using is from NutriSense. You, as a type 1 diabetic, what are your thoughts on this, and how is it different for you?
So, yeah, I mean, as you were saying all that, I was just thinking, you know. And I one of the podcasts of yours I listened to was the one where you interviewed the two type ones who do a lot of fruit, I think it was.
The guys from Mastering Diabetes.
Yeah, yeah. And because I saw type one and I was like, oh yeah, I'm listening to this, see what they say. You know, and you know, obviously I ate the opposite diet of what they do. But in my experience, so like when I went full animal based, and even before that, when I had eliminated carbohydrates, I just found it easier to regulate blood sugar. But the thing was, and that I wasn't anticipating, was that when I ate any carbohydrate whatsoever, I would have to use a very fast acting insulin and larger amounts of it. Right. And so now, I didn't even think about it. So then I went animal based and I was eating higher quantities of protein. And I tried to, because I had to give a little bit of insulin for protein, less, but I have to give some, but I was using that fast acting in all the quantity I would need to give for that meal. And I would go low an hour later, you know, my blood sugar would go low. And to me, I didn't take into account the fact that the reason that protein, I think, is more blood sugar stabilizing is because it doesn't create this spike in glucose. And so my body is having to secrete, mine isn't, but the average person's body is secreting the insulin like at a very slow amount. So we don't get huge spikes in insulin and we're just covering that protein. And so I had to switch to a different insulin that didn't activate so quickly and lasted longer, and it was a night and day change. And so when I think about that in the context of coronavirus, I'm thinking that, okay, so clearly, you made the statement, carbohydrates are bad. And obviously those two guys you interviewed are achieving some insulin sensitivity with a high carbohydrate diet. However, I still think that doing that is probably going to cause spikes in blood sugar. You're able to, you're able to handle that with the insulin you're using, but it's spiking it higher. And if in the context of coronavirus, if higher amounts of blood sugar are making it more able to gain access to our cells, is that what we really want to be doing? You know? And so yeah, it's just interesting when I just thought about that, how, you know, I had to shift things like that. And it told me that, you know, despite having to give, you know, still give insulin for protein, it's just, it's really spread out. It's not this one big surge in blood sugar and then insulin right behind it. So yeah, I would say that that could be one of the reasons why diabetes is showing to be associated with poor outcomes with this virus.
Yeah. And we'll in a moment get into other molecular mechanisms of insulin resistance and immune cell sort of impairment. But yeah, I guess the question that I've been wrestling with is a bump of blood sugar of 30 to 40 milligrams per deciliter that lasts for 30 minutes really impairing the immune system? My feeling is it's probably not. The studies we have are taking the blood sugar really high. And I think that if most people who are eating carbohydrates, again, from my perspective, they're not bad in and of themselves. I don't think humans necessarily need them. Again, I'm doing a short-term experiment with them for my own edification and for all of the listeners' edification and for an upcoming cookbook that I'm writing. But my suspicion is that a 30 to 40 milligram bump, milligram per deciliter bump in the blood sugar that lasts for a short amount of time is probably not a negative thing. But there's a real difference between that and a 250 milligram per deciliter bump in the blood sugar. So I think that for me, I can't say across the board that carbohydrate consumption is going to impair the immune response or is going to be a negative thing in coronavirus. But I do think it's important to point out that hyperglycemia to the level of like 250 milligrams per deciliter or large postprandial bumps in blood sugar that last for long amounts of time certainly could. And there's probably a threshold at which that happens. Now, as we said, I think it's a different situation for someone with type 1 diabetes. And in that situation, I think that, you know, a low carb diet is probably the best thing in general. And those guys on my podcast were fruitarians. If the listener wants to go back and listen to that, it's from a while ago. It's the folks who wrote the book Mastering Diabetes. Super nice guys. And I am not a fan of the way they are eating and think that it's going to be very, very nutrient deficient. But they were. It was interesting to have some kind of granular scientific conversations with them about insulin resistance in general. So I'll just move on to another study that I found that's interesting. So this is a paper about immune dysfunction in patients with diabetes mellitus, and this is type 2. Although there are some studies that suggest that type 1 diabetics may have the same things. But you'll see in the abstract here, patients with diabetes have infections more often than those without. The course of infections is more complicated. And they note that there are observed differences, decreased cellular responses in test tubes, in innate immunity, specifically low complement factor 4, decreased cytokine response after stimulation, and also innate the immunity impaired in terms of chemotaxis, which is moving to organisms that they're trying to get rid of, or viruses, phagocytosis, which is engulfing them and killing them. And so all of these functions of these immune cells appear to be impaired in people with diabetes. Have you seen things like this? What's your sense of what's going on in people with diabetes and the immune response?
I think that it kind of makes sense. I mean, I don't know that, I mean, because if we look at it with diabetes, it's obviously a delayed or impaired response to insulin. And so who knows what else this could be impairing. And that study right there you just pulled up shows that it's impairing a response of the immune system. As far as a direct mechanism, I don't know, maybe it's the higher amounts of sugar giving the bacteria or virus or whatever an advantage. Again, maybe we're just feeding it. And that's what I guess was pointing out with, you know, anytime you eat carbohydrates, you're going to get a higher spike. Doesn't mean that unless you're, I mean, there's a big difference between, you know, like you said, that 50 milligrams per deciliter and 250, you know, but I think that carbohydrates in this sense, especially processed ones that spike blood sugar, even if your body can handle it, are delaying a lot of responses that your body has. Immune response, and they're definitely an insulin response.
Yeah. I just think it's important to clarify what that spike looks like. You know, I'm not convinced that the blood sugar needs to look absolutely flat for everyone to have a properly functioning immune system. And I should differentiate, and I appreciate you bringing this up, between processed and unprocessed carbohydrates. I certainly think that processed grains and flours and sugars are going to be the massive problem here. And maybe I'll do another podcast on honey in the future and some of the data that honey doesn't seem to act quite like a processed sugar, because it's not really a processed sugar at all. But I'll just share one more study that I think kind of speaks to this point as well. So in terms of molecular mechanisms, there is insulin receptor mediated stimulation of T cells. And I would imagine that there is insulin receptor mediated stimulation of all of the other cells of our innate immune system. So for those who are watching on YouTube or visually, I'll pull up another chart, which is quite helpful for people. You guys all know that when you listen to this podcast, you get to go back to medical school with all of us. So this is the innate immune system. This is the adaptive immune system. And the innate immune system consists of cells, macrophages, dendritic cells, mast cells, basophils, eosinophils, neutrophils, and natural killer cells. Macrophages and dendritic cells are derived from the monocyte lineage. I think I have a whole graphic of all of the lineages. And this is getting a little bit granular for people, but you can see there's a stem cell. The stem cell divides into either a myeloid progenitor or a lymphoid progenitor. This is where we get the term lymphocytes on the CBC. Lymphocytes can include things like natural killer cells or T cells and B cells. B cells canonically produce antibodies. T cells are subdivided into other classes, which we don't have to go into today, though we will talk a little bit about this as we wrap up the podcast. CD4 positive T cells, CD8 positive T cells. Of the CD4 positive T cells, there are multiple types of T cells, including Treg, which we're going to talk about in the context of statins in a moment, Th17, T helper 2, T helper 1, T helper 0. So that's all the adaptive immunity. And on the other side here, this innate immunity is really what we're talking about with diabetics and the impairment. We have the myeloid progenitor going to mast cells, and then all these other cells, monocytes, dendritic cells, macrophages, eosinophils, basophils, neutrophils. The listener may have heard me talk about macrophage. This is probably a little too granular for this podcast, but this ability of macrophages to switch between M1 and M2 phenotypes, meaning activated and non-activated, is very interesting to me. And the context for this discussion previously has been in the setting of a lot of brain-derived macrophages, which are called microglial cells, and how they can switch from the M1 to M2 phenotype, meaning getting turned on, and we see neuroinflammation in the brain. But that's just a whole separate discussion. Anyway, I think that there's very good evidence that insulin is going to be signaling in all of these cells. So just like that article, which I'll go back to in a moment, insulin is signaling in T cells tonically, insulin is also going to be a signal for all of these cells. And what we know, and you alluded to this, is that when we are insulin resistant, most of the cells of our body become insulin resistant. It's not just our liver or our muscles that become insulin resistant. I think that what we see in diabetes is that we have immune cell insulin resistance. And so this paper is just talking about how immune cells are signaling in T cells during inflammation and infection. And you can imagine how in a situation of insulin resistance, if the T cell or the dendritic cell or the macrophage or the NK cell is insulin resistant, they're not going to respond as well in inflammation or infection. So I thought that was really fascinating and speaks to the idea that insulin resistance in people with COVID could be really bad because your immune cells can't respond to the virus because they're not hearing insulin. What do you think about that?
I think that, yeah. So for people like, you know, talking about, you know, an innate and adaptive immune systems and things like that, like, when I think of innate immune system, I think, you know, that's, you know, the virus isn't necessarily making me sick as far as like what I feel is being sick. My innate immune system fighting back from that is what is making me feel those symptoms of being sick. You know, the fever and whether it's a cough or whatever, you know, those symptoms of your body trying to fight it. And so I like to give people that visualization, like that's how much inflammation is going on. you know, in the context of when we contract some bacteria or virus. And so that the very nature of how our body fights a virus is going to make us a little resistant to insulin, I think. And so if you've already got pre-existing resistance to insulin, it's just way worse.
Yes, it's going to make it way, way worse and going to create a real problem for humans with this. And I think this is a big thing. And this is a big piece of the equation that if our immune system isn't going to respond properly, this is essentially what happens with ARDS. You know, ARDS, we talked about it a little bit earlier, it's acute respiratory distress syndrome. It's when we get this cytokine storm in the lungs and the immune system goes absolutely haywire. I think that in addition to responding sluggishly, if we are insulin resistant or immune signaling is disordered, our immune systems could respond excessively or lead to this cytokine storm as well. So it's just a really dangerous thing for patients. And I want to really emphasize that there is such a connection between insulin sensitivity and the immune function. And this is a huge part of the conversation that needs to be had. I'll mention just one more study, a couple more studies, impaired cytokine expression, neutrophil infiltration, and bacterial clearance in response to urinary tract infections in diabetic mice. Again, these are in mice and it's a bacterial infection, but we're seeing the same pattern of impaired immune response in mice that are insulin resistant. And I think that's actually a really, again, a really interesting finding with regard to this as well. And we talked about this one. And the last one that I want to share is a study looking at, well, there's a couple here. So there's actually an editorial. This goes back to our previous points. So this is a correspondence from The Lancet, and the title of the paper is "Are Patients with Hypertension and Diabetes at Increased Risk for COVID-19 Infection?" This is published March 13th, 2020, or March 11th, 2020. So, you know, this is an interesting thing. This is not something that is fringe. I think a lot of people are concerned that this is definitely a problem for patients with coronavirus and perhaps one of the main issues with coronavirus. We talked about this one, I believe, another study, clinical course and risk factors of mortality in adult inpatients with COVID-19. And then there's one more here. We'll get to that one in a moment. All right. So let's move on and talk for a moment about, well, before we do that, in light of everything we've just talked about, I want to show one article, which I think is just hilarious. So in the light of everything we have talked about, my friend, what do you think about this article from Pop Sugar? This is published on March 31st. It's written by Jenny Sugar. I don't know if that's her real name. And the title of the study is "Why You Shouldn't Worry About Stress Eating, Overeating, or Gaining Weight Right Now." Unfortunately, it has 2,300 shares. So it has 23,000 shares. What do you think about this article in light of everything we've talked about?
I got to say right off the bat that I'm curious why she's saying it's not, like, what her conclusion is. Why is she saying we shouldn't worry about it? You know, is she saying that it'll help you deal with anxiety? But I don't know. And if she is saying that, then there are clearly better ways we can deal with the anxiety of the situation based on what we just talked about. But yeah, that's unfortunately what's out there, and it's getting a lot of attention.
I just thought that was pretty sad to see that paper out there.
Yeah, very sad.
To see people saying, I mean, look, I get the idea. We're all stressed. And maybe we can talk about this in a moment as we wrap up the podcast. We're all stressed. And I don't think people should get overly stressed or panicked. And I appreciate where they're coming from. You know, everyone is stressed and the stress eating. But to condone stress eating, I think in this situation, flies in the face of what we're talking about here, which is, hey, you know, your immune system is important and obesity is important and insulin sensitivity is important. This is a big deal. And we should not ignore this at all. So yeah. Let's talk about the last piece of this equation, which I think is super, or another piece of this equation as we begin to wrap up, which I find to be super interesting, which is the role of cholesterol in the immune system and Your thoughts on this? Most of my listeners will know, as I talk about in my book, I am not someone that ascribes to the traditional model of LDL, but I would love to hear your thoughts on this and how you think cholesterol or lipoproteins might be involved in the immune response and if this is relevant to coronavirus.
Yeah, definitely. And I've talked a lot about this as well. I definitely don't, you know, subscribe to the traditional thinking that cholesterol is you know, problematic or I guess directly causative in heart disease. And I think in times like this, it's really necessary that we step back and look at how this molecule could be helping us, you know, and how maybe not having it is hurting us. And so what I've looked at, so in the post that I did, I cited three studies, and each of those studies looked at they were basically studies that were trying to develop a drug, an antiviral drug. And so what these researchers were doing was they were taking various peptides and they were conjugating or you know, teaming up cholesterol with these peptides and seeing if it made it more successful at combating a virus. And so that doesn't necessarily, you know, equate to something that may happen in the body, because, you know, who knows if these molecules, these peptides they were using, or something that cholesterol could team up with. However, it's just interesting to know that when they did, you know, conjugate cholesterol with these peptides, they became much more potent at killing a virus. And they specifically mentioned in one of the studies coronaviruses. They listed a whole bunch of viruses, but they specifically mentioned coronaviruses. Obviously, they couldn't, you know, haven't looked at this new one that we have, but. So that was interesting. And then, you know, I've known for a while, and I found a lot of research that shows that cholesterol is very effective at binding and neutralizing directly things like endotoxins, like LPS and things like that. And so then I started looking a little deeper for anything specific to viruses. And I found some pretty good things. You know, people, it's definitely well known in the research that cholesterol can directly bind and neutralize a lot of different pathogenic things, bacteria, viruses, and parasites. And then, you know, and we can go through some of those if you want. And then I even found one, study here that said that called bioactive, lipids, can inactivate coronavirus, COVID-19. And they're talking a lot about arachidonic acid, which is oftentimes touted as, you know, being, you know, one of the more inflammatory things, or it causes inflammation, but we still need inflammation sometimes. But it's interesting to know that there, to note that arachidonic acid comes in animal foods, largely, you know, lots of times fish, but also eggs and beef and things like that. And then I guess the last most interesting thing I found was there was one, it's like a research paper, but also kind of a case study, because it looks like the researchers who did this in China were noticing, you know, that cholesterol levels were kind of dropping when people contracted the virus. So they did this, they measured in this one lady from, like, I guess it was the day of or the day, or like maybe a little bit prior to when they started measuring cholesterol. And they found that once she contracted the virus, her cholesterol dropped pretty significantly. I mean, if you're talking about millimoles per liter here, it went from, looks like, you know, 5.3 to almost 3.5 within the first, looks like, 3 or 4 days.
Is this total cholesterol?
Yes. And so to me, I mean, who knows what that means exactly? It could be that there's a lot of inflammation the cholesterol is helping combat. Could be that the cholesterol is helping the immune system specifically fight these viruses, or that the cholesterol is being used to bind and neutralize these viruses or the viral particles. But clearly, I think all this shows that cholesterol is playing a role here. And I think, you know, messing with our body's potential ability or availability of cholesterol could be affecting us in some way.
Absolutely. And I make this point strongly in my book, and I talk about many studies in the book suggesting that people with higher levels of total cholesterol and higher levels of LDL, at least in observational studies, are some of the longest lived people. They have less infections, and higher cholesterol levels are represented strongly in people who live too long ages. If you look at people with all sorts of illnesses, everything from HIV to influenza, the people with higher levels of total cholesterol and LDL appear to do better. Again, a number of those studies are referenced in my book. I pulled up a couple of the studies that I want to mention from your blog post, which I'll also link to in the show notes for this episode, but I'll show people this on the screen share. Dramatic potentiation of antiviral activity of HIV antibodies by cholesterol conjugation. Again, cholesterol, we are using the word cholesterol in terms of a cholesterol molecule, which is a steroid molecule. And then we're also going to talk about lipoprotein particles like LDL, but that's an interesting strategy that when you conjugate HIV neutralizing antibodies to cholesterol, they become more efficacious. And then another study here, the addition of cholesterol to an HIV-1 peptide fusion inhibitor dramatically increases antiviral potency. And then even more than that, let's look at this one. Capturing a fusion intermediate of influenza hemagglutinin with a cholesterol conjugated peptide, a new antiviral strategy from influenza virus. And then the last one, which was, can bioactive lipids inactivate coronavirus? They talk about, and this is published March 27th, 2020, SARS-CoV-2, SARS and MERS are all enveloped viruses. Arachidonic acid and other unsaturated fatty acids, especially eicosapentaenoic acid and DHA, are known to inactivate enveloped viruses and inhibit proliferation of various microbial organisms. Well, isn't that interesting? Because where do we get arachidonic acid, EPA, and DHA from? We get it from animal foods. People who have read both of our work will know that humans are generally really miserable at converting ALA, alpha-linolenic acid, to EPA and DHA, but the preformed EPA and DHA are found in animal foods. I'm not aware of many sources of arachidonic acid in the plant kingdom. Are you?
No, and I even looked hard, and I there was none. Nobody just kind of pointed it out and said, oh yeah, this food definitely. I mean, if it was anything, it was very low amounts, you know? So yeah, it seems pretty animal-based.
Again, this is sort of an opinion paper, but it is interesting. It says, hence oral or intravenous administration of arachidonic acid or other unsaturated fatty acids may aid in enhancing resistance and recovery from SARS-CoV-2, SARS, and MERS infections. Previous in here in the abstract, they also say pro-inflammatory metabolites of arachidonic acid and EPA, such as prostaglandins, leukotrienes, and thyroxines, induce inflammation, whereas lipoxins, resolvins, protectins, and maresins derived from arachidonic acid, EPA, and DHA not only suppress inflammation, but also enhance wound healing and augment phagocytosis of macrophages and other immunocytes and decrease microbial load. So that's a mouthful, but what they're saying is that these unsaturated fatty acids play a role in the immune response. They do appear to activate these viruses, and when we are thinking about who is healthy in the population, no one is actually measuring what is your level of arachidonic acid, what is your level of EPA, what is your level of DHA, where do we get these things from? I think you and I both agree we get these things from animals, which is why we can say that animal foods are the best multivitamin on the planet, and probably it's reasonable to suggest that including high-quality animal foods in your diet right now would be a very good thing. Would you agree with that? I imagine you would.
Right now and all the time, definitely.
All the time, exactly. Exactly. So what about statins? Because this, I talk about this a little bit in my book. In your post, you pointed me to an article that I will highlight on the screen share in a moment that was pretty striking about statins. What's your thought about statins in the middle of all this? At the beginning of the podcast, we talked about ACE2 and ARBs and angiotensin receptor blockers. And I think statins are another drug that's super controversial that no one is talking about with regard to coronavirus. And I would love to see some epidemiologic analysis of whether statin use is making people more susceptible to coronavirus.
Yeah, I'd love to see that too. So when I first started looking into this, I, you know, just went to search, and a lot of what was coming up was, you know, statin use is boosting the immune system and all this kind of stuff. And so there was a lot of those. And so I just started picking through them and reading them, and every single one of them ended with, but the results were not statistically significant, or you know, it was are weakly associated with this or that kind of stuff. So it wasn't really convincing, and it was largely associational kind of things. And so, but I did find a few studies. One showed that there was a direct correlation with people who were in the hospital recovering from some procedure, and those that were on statins were more likely to get an infection than those who weren't. And so that's, I think, pretty relevant because, you know, lots of people who are in the hospital fighting this virus, you know, and so they're surrounded by infections, not just the coronavirus. And then the other study that I found that I didn't even think about was that statin use increased Treg cells, which you were talking about earlier when you were talking about the immune system. And so the important thing there is that an increase in Treg cells is going to decrease the immune system, an immune system response. And so that's definitely problematic in this setting. And so, you know, when I think about, you know, the whole paradigm of, you know, cholesterol is problematic, and if you have high cholesterol, you're getting heart disease and all that kind of stuff. People, you know, within that viewpoint are being told, you know, that stop eating cholesterol foods, rich foods, you know, they're being given statin drugs. And then we have this evidence that cholesterol plays a key role in the immune system, I think. And then we also have this evidence that statins can maybe downregulate our immune system. And those are two things we don't necessarily want right now, you know. And this is the message I think that's getting out there. And this is what the people with these comorbidities we're talking about, with hypertension and diabetes and heart disease, these are the things that these people are being told. So, you know, I think that if we think about it from that perspective, all that we've talked about as far as insulin resistance, you know, higher glucose given viruses, things like that, who knows exactly what it is, or a combination of all of these things that's making people, you know, more susceptible to this virus. Who knows which one it is, or if it's a combination of all of them. But we just clearly see that not only are these pre-existing conditions that people have, that as a society, a lot of people have predisposed them to worse outcomes, but also the approach that Western medicine is taking to correcting these imbalances is quite possibly making people more vulnerable to something like this when this happens, not just coronavirus, but anytime something like this happens.
Well said. And I was thinking the same thing. Think about a patient with diabetes. They're on an ACE inhibitor and they're on a statin. And is that just the perfect storm? Now, traditionally, that's what we know may improve their outcomes in terms of chronic disease. But I think that we must be realistic in the appraisal of the situation and realize that medications don't solve the problem. They cover a symptom. And when it's like whack-a-mole, we can give someone a statin, which will decrease their LDL. But is that really the mechanism by which we achieve increased cardiovascular outcomes? Improved cardiovascular outcomes? I would say no. And then what are the side effects of those medications? Listeners of this podcast will know that I am very interested in thinking about the side effects of plant molecules. Well, right now we're directly talking about the side effects of pharmaceutical molecules, which are really unintended. And could statins have an unintended effect on the immune system? Certainly, if we believe that cholesterol or lipoproteins containing cholesterol, like LDL and HDL, more specifically LDL in this context, are involved in the immune response, could inhibiting the formation of one of the most vital molecules in the cell membranes throughout our human body and every immune cell in the human body be a bad thing in the setting of an immune infection? You bet it could. It absolutely could. I said that all really fast. I felt like a rapper there for a second. I was like spitting some flow there.
Just to give people an example, it's my own personal story. This is obviously not true for everybody, but, you know, I already talked about how I was offered or prescribed a lisinopril, blood pressure medication, not because my blood pressure was high, but because that was the standard of care for anyone who'd been type 1 diabetic as long as I have. And then the other drug I've been prescribed is a statin drug. And again, not because my cholesterol was high at the time of the office visit, but because that was the standard of care for anybody who'd been type 1 diabetic as long as I have. And so it's not that the people and the doctors were, you know, maliciously doing this. It's just what's been taught, you know. And, you know, when someone like me comes in there even though I work really hard to be healthy, and I think I am very healthy, even though I walk in there with what they would describe as perfect health, because the standard of care says to give me this drug, then that's what they give me, you know? And so, you know, with all that we've talked about, that could have predisposed me to a worse outcome if I contracted this virus during this time.
And the better thing to do in general is to try and correct the root cause. In your case, if it's an autoimmune attack on the pancreas and you don't catch it early enough, it's hard to correct the root cause. But you can correct the root cause of diabetics getting, or type 1 diabetics getting atherosclerosis, presumably, depending on what model of atherosclerosis we're operating from. But you can try and correct the root cause of diabetic kidney disease and metabolic dyslipidemia by maintaining level blood sugars, by removing inflammation, and by making yourself as insulin sensitive as possible. The great irony of people, of patients who have both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, is that insulin doesn't fix insulin resistance, and that very few patients with diabetes are being told to avoid vegetable oils, or sometimes they're being told to avoid processed carbohydrates, but other times they're just being told to take more insulin. And so how many patients with diabetes are actually being educated about what might cause the insulin resistance that is underlying their disease? And in your case, there's not really insulin resistance in type 1 diabetes, but in type 2 diabetes, diabetics are not being told what causes insulin resistance. This is kind of the beating of the drum of Jason Fung, is that type 2 diabetics are just being shoved with more insulin and no one is correcting the underlying insulin resistance. But that's what you are able to do, or at least try to get to the root cause of these things, which is really in what situation we will be able to affect the immunologic response to everything and the whole body works better. We can't play whack-a-mole with meds. It doesn't make any sense.
Exactly.
I want to share.
And I've been in so many endocrinologists' offices over my life, you know, and before it was like specialist for type 1, but then as I got older, it was just general endocrinologist. So, you know, they're seeing patients with type 2 as well. And I can't tell you how many, you know, magazine articles or little advertisements in the office I see of yes, lower carbohydrate foods that are still extremely processed foods.
Exactly.
You know, and full of vegetable oils. And it's just like, this is wrong. This is completely wrong. I have to get out of this office.
Oh my God. I want to screen share a couple of these articles that you were talking about. So this is early statin use is associated with increased risk of infection after stroke. Well, that's concerning, you know. Our data suggests that early statin use appears to be associated with an increased risk of post-stroke infection. This may be in part related to increases in plasma interleukin-1 RA. If these findings are replicated in larger studies, they could have important implications for the timing of statin therapy after stroke. So that's a little concerning. Why is someone getting more infection? The listener may or may not know that it's becoming standard of care to use statins after stroke to potentially affect neuronal plasticity, but this may be one of the downsides of that. There was a trial associated with that. I believe it was called the FLAME trial, if I'm recalling properly, about statin use and stroke. But again, that has to do with neuroplasticity, but this is potentially a downside of that and speaks to what we are talking about here, which is that statin use changing cholesterol metabolism could affect the immune system negatively. This is perhaps one of the more interesting studies that I found in your blog post, the double-edged sword of statin immunomodulation. And as you suggested, statin-inducing T regulatory cells may be detrimental in neurodegenerative disorders, such as ALS, which is called amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease, and a myriad of infectious diseases, including but not limited to HIV, hepatitis B virus, hepatitis C virus, varicella zoster virus, and presumably, potentially, other viruses as well. So that is a pretty striking article about the double-edged sword of statins in immunomodulation and speaks to what you were saying regarding Treg cells and whether you actually want to be increasing Treg cells during an acute infection. This is the study that we were both referring to from The Lancet, looking at low serum cholesterol levels among patients with COVID-19 infection in Wenzhou, China. And the authors of this study will note that the levels of HDL and LDL were lower in patients who had severe COVID-19 courses. And the levels in this paper are reported in millimole per liter. I did the calculations, converted them to what we're all familiar with milligrams per deciliter. And the HDL levels in patients with more severe COVID-19 courses were 45 milligrams per deciliter, and the LDL levels were 70 milligrams per deciliter. So interestingly, we know that people with low HDL, that's correlated with insulin resistance. And if the listener has read my book, I present a reappraisal of the data from the Framingham study showing that low HDL is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease in and of itself. And in the setting of LDL, higher levels of LDL are much more of a risk factor or correlate much more strongly with cardiovascular disease when someone has low HDL, indicative or suggestive of insulin resistance. So in these patients, I think that it's pretty darn suspicious that they have low HDL and low LDL. The low LDL may be playing a role in the immunologic function. The low HDL could be an indication of insulin resistance, which is what we've been talking about the whole podcast. And low HDL. HDL does appear to have a role in the immune function as well. So I think that's a, man, I think we just took that, you know, we just went full circle on that. Anything else you want to add to this as we wrap up?
I mean, I'll add that, just on that last point there, I was thinking in my head that, you know, I've had low HDL my whole life, and my doctors always said, as I was a kid and in my 20s, they were like, you know, exercise more, that's going to increase it. And I was like, dude, there's no way I can be more active. I'm playing soccer. I'm lifting weights. I'm doing all kinds of stuff every day. The only time I've seen it go up is when I went to a carnivore diet.
You did. The HDL went up when you went to a carnivore diet.
Yeah, it would hover around like 32, 35, something like that. And now it hovers around 45, which is still not the best, but it's the only time I've ever seen it go up.
Well, this also speaks to the fact that HDL metabolism is nuanced, and most lipidologists would say that just looking at the absolute HDL number is not the whole story. And that's sort of the flaw in all the HDL research. I think overall the trends are that higher HDL is better, but in my clinical experience, there are some people that appear to have lower HDL genetically. And I think that in people who have lower HDL genetically, what we may be seeing is different flux or movement in the system. It may be trafficking at different speeds. And that in that case, you know, presumably or potentially increasing your LDL is a good thing. But yeah, there's some nuance there. Overall, I think in population studies, what we see is that an HDL number will go down in the setting of insulin resistance. Where that HDL number starts and your genetic basis for where your HDL is a little bit more murky at this point, but that's a great point to bring up. And it's interesting that yours went up.
Yeah.
The carnivore diet. So cool. All right, man. Well, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. We covered a lot. We could probably go on for another few hours. We'll have to do another one soon. Where can people find more of your work and your stuff?
My website is resourceyourhealth.com. And that's where I do like my coaching and my books on there and my blog. And then I'm also on social media on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. It's just Dr. Stephen Hussey. So they can find me there.
Cool. I'll do a screen share here. The Overlooked Tragedy of Coronavirus is the blog post that we're sort of thinking about here. And my last question that I have for all of my guests, you've heard my podcast, you know this question.
Yeah.
What is the most radical thing that you have done recently?
I didn't think about it, so I didn't prepare. Well, I mean, it's kind of nerdy. Here's another one. I'll do this one. So it's been getting warmer outside. I've been, you know what slacklining is?
I do it myself, man. I love it. I'm going to go slackline this afternoon.
I've got my slackline out. That's probably what I'm going to do after this. I've got it out. And last week, for the first time, I was able to jump off the slackline and land back on it.
What?
Yeah.
Why have you not posted videos of this on Instagram?
Because I've only done it once and I was scared to death. So that's probably the most radical thing I've done.
That's pretty cool. So for people that don't know what a slackline is, describe it for them.
You can think about it like at the circle, like a tightrope walking kind of thing, but it's wider than a tightrope would be. And it's got more slack in it, I think, which is why they call it a slack line. So it's basically like balancing. I just tie it between two trees and I walk on the line between two trees and It's amazing proprioceptive exercise. I'm a huge proponent of getting not only every joint to move through its full range of motion every day, but also to train the proprioceptors in your joints so you have proper motion. I think it's the best form of it.
I love it. So yeah, it basically slacklining is tightrope walking yeah. without a stick. There's no stick. You're just on there. I've posted about it on my Instagram in the past. I do it. It doesn't sound like I'm as good as you, but how long is the slackline that you usually walk?
The slackline I have, I think the total of it is 120 feet, but I rarely have it out that long. I'd say it just depends on the distance between the trees that I have. You know, out in my yard, there's one that's probably about 50 or 60 feet. So it definitely gets harder the longer it is, because when you get to the middle, it starts
wobbling like crazy.
So, probably 50 or 60, I would say.
50 or 60, that's a long slack line. That's a long slack line. I think that the longest one that I've ever put up is like 80 feet. To be able to walk across that took me a long time to figure out. And I've gotten so rusty that I'm not very good at it. But thanks for coming on, man. We'll have to talk more soon.
For sure.
All right. Thank you for joining me. Thank you so much for being here this week on the podcast. I feel that this was such an important conversation with Dr. Steven Hussey. And you can check out his stuff at resourceyourhealth.com. He has written a couple of books, and I so appreciated this discussion with him about insulin resistance, lipids, angiotensin II receptors, statins, and who might be at the most risk for serious illness in the times of coronavirus. This is a wake-up call for all of us to help those in our lives who may not be as healthy as we are, and to help educate the public about what creates the highest risk in times of viruses and illnesses. And I think that insulin resistance is one of the major, major factors here, as we know. So please check out my book, The Carnivore Code, thecarnivorecodebook.com. It's on Amazon. It's a bestseller. There is so much good information in my book. It is on ebook and it is print. The audiobook will be out later this year in August when the book is republished with my new publisher, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, HMH. Much appreciation to them. It will be for sale until that time under my label as a self-published book, but in August it will be re-released as a trade paperback with a big five publisher in New York, and we will try and get it everywhere to really move this message into a much broader sphere. So stay tuned for all of those exciting things with my book, but you can get it right now. TheCarnivoreCodebook.com. Thank you also for your support of this podcast. Please leave me a review on Amazon for the book and leave me a review on iTunes for this podcast. If you appreciate it, it is how we move things forward. I think we will get through all of this. I know we will get through all of this. I am sending all of my love and good vibes to you and your family, and hoping that this next week will be great for you. Please share this podcast if you find it valuable, and stay radical, and I will talk to you next week.